This is Eric Elmas, once again with Crosswalk America's podcast, and this evening I am very pleased to be sitting with Brian McLaren. Brian is the author of many books, my very favorite of which is A Generous Orthodoxy, I think one of the most important books, actually, that's been written in the last 20 years. So I'm extremely excited that, Brian, that you would you'd join us this evening. Brian, you have had a lot of involvement in recent years with a phenomenon that a lot of more mainline Christians are not as aware of out there, called the emergent church, or I mean, I know there's different names for that, and people kind of resist labels, and I know you've written on that, in fact. But can you just for initiate us into what is variously known as the emergent church movement?
Sure. Well, by way of the story behind it, back in the 90s, a lot of mostly evangelical pastors around the country started hearing the same sentence being said, and the sentence was, we have no one between 18 and 35. And they started realizing that there was this age gap, that when kids were graduating from high school, they were dropping out of church, and there just was this gap. And so they identified it back in the 90s with Gen X, and everybody started talking about Gen X ministry and what's different about Gen X. And as often is the case, some of these early meetings involved people my age, baby boomers, pontificating about Gen X. And when they finally got some Gen X people involved, they said, if you use the word Gen X one more time, we're going to throw up and walk out of the room. You know, they said, this is not about tattoos and earrings and candles and stylistic things. There is a shift going on in our culture, and it's a philosophical shift. It's a cultural shift. It's a political shift. It's all these changes, and it's deeper than just an age group. And that conversation continued to develop among a lot of younger leaders and then some older people who were trying to understand what is this cultural change we're going through. And as I said, it started with a lot of evangelical and charismatic and Pentecostal leaders, but very quickly we found that there were a lot of mainline leaders really interested in talking about these issues because they were noticing the same thing, no one between 18 and 35, and for some of them, it was no one between 18 and 45 or 55. And in fact, some of them, it's no one between 12 and 55 because their kids drop out of church even sooner. We also found a lot of Roman Catholics who were eager to talk about this, so it's been very exciting. And most recently, we've had a number of rabbis interested in talking. So it's just expanded into a fascinating conversation about how do we grapple with these deep, historic, cultural changes in our faith communities.
So if I were to walk into a church that may be self-identifying as emergent, what would I expect to see there that's different from what I might expect to see in a typical mainline church, for instance?
You know, I think, first, you won't find very many of these that identify as emergent. My guess is, in a lot of cases, if you do, you should be suspicious, because a lot of these folks are working very much against the uniformity. You know, they don't want to create a franchise mentality. But there would be certain things that you'd experience, but I don't think they'd be different. For example, your church would, I think, be so much so similar to this. A couple of guys from Fuller Seminary wrote a book, Eddie Gibbs and Ryan Bolger, called Emerging Churches, and they did something quite smart. They decided to actually talk to some leaders of these churches in several different countries, and somehow they worked networks to find out about different ones. And they came up with 8 characteristics that they shared in common, none of which are matters of style, form, or uniform structure. The first and most significant is theological. It is to be centered on Christ and his message of the kingdom of God, which is, you might say, oh, everybody's centered on that. But that's not true. A lot of our mainline churches are centered on being good citizens. It's sort of a civil religion, institution of society mentality, and very little understanding of the kingdom of God. And many of our, are of Jesus' message of the kingdom of God, and very many of our evangelical churches are centered on escaping the earth and going to heaven after they die, leaving the earth behind, etc., etc., which is the polar opposite of the message of the kingdom of God. But then the other things that flowed from it were an emphasis on participation in worship rather than worship being a spectator sport, so to speak, that all the people of God come together and participate in worship. A loss of the old sacred secular dualism. So there would be an interest, for example, not in creating a little subculture genre of Christian music or religious film or religious broadcasting, but say, well, no, let's talk about the religious dimensions of contemporary film and of different musicians who are not known as religious musicians, to take all of culture seriously. A desire to lead through networks more than hierarchies. A sense that church is primarily about community rather than institution. Those sorts of things. But I think you'll find that, that's just very pervasive. Those changes are emerging in a lot of places.
Yeah, they certainly are. We found those along the walk this summer quite a bit, and we're very intrigued by that. One of the things that Crosswalk kind of leadership talks about is that we're not really interested, well, we are interested in what's happening right now and politically and socially and so forth, but we're really interested as an organization in Christianity in the next 500 years, not simply next year or the next election cycle, what have you. What would be your advice if you were to be able to say, I think we ought to do the next, we need to do 3, 4, whatever things that would really influence Christianity or be important for Christianity to shape it in the next 500 years. What would those things be in your opinion?
Well, I mean, the very first thing that comes to my mind is exactly what you're doing, thinking with a long time frame. I remember I heard someone say, imagine it's 10,000 AD and the first 2,000 years of church history take up about 4 pages in the church history book. So things that we're all bent out of shape about suddenly become, much less significant. I'll use an example. I think that all of the debates about homosexuality are actually the tip of the iceberg about, and what's under the surface is a drastic need to rethink what we might call our theological anthropology, our view of what human beings are. Most of our Christians still are operating under a view of what a human being is that is, it's not really formed by the Bible. It's formed by Neoplatonism, and it's formed by Rene Descartes and all kinds of cultural influences that they're completely unaware of, but that have formed a Christian understanding of what a human being is. And not just Christian, a Western civilization understanding. And now we're coping with so many things from genetics to psychopharmacology to neurobiology, all of these new and almost embryonic understandings of what a human being is, and we have to come to terms with this in our theology as well. We're at the end, maybe not at the end, maybe in the middle of this long era of individualism, and that came after a long era of a different kind of communalism. And now we're trying to integrate a concern for the community and a concern for the individual in the context of now needing to care about the planet. Oh gosh, these are huge, huge issues. So to me, what you just said is probably the most important thing. To have a longer time frame and not always be thinking in terms of the Earth is going to end next year or something. We've been around for 2,000 years. Let's think long term.
You wrote a very generous letter of support for Crosswalk America's closing rally in Washington, D.C. on September 3rd. And you've had a chance to kind of familiarize yourself with Crosswalk America and the Phoenix Affirmations. I was wondering if you have any comment on the Phoenix Affirmations, what you see in them, or strengths, weaknesses, challenge points, or hope, or what have you.
You and I were just having dinner, and we were talking about some of these things over dinner, and I think you said that the two most controversial ones were the first one that deals with respecting the legitimacy of other religions.
And, or at least not denying the legitimacy of religion.
Yeah. And what was the other one?
And number 9, which says that, in effect, God's love goes to all people for eternity.
Yes. And, of course, those issues raise a lot of concerns for, I really was born in a fundamentalist background, and I was raised in an evangelical background, so I my tribe, and they get nervous about those things very, very quickly. And I think what part of that tension is about, something that very few people have thought about, it's the relationship between Christian faith and colonialism. We don't realize the degree to which our faith has been complicit with a European colonialism that was expressed in slavery, it was expressed in apartheid, and it was expressed just in this unbelievable confidence of Europeans that they could go take over other countries, use their resources, reduce the people to tenant farmers on their own land, so to speak. Just really quite amazing. And I think what's happened since the Holocaust, especially, is that Europeans now have realized something was really wrong with the way we were doing civilization. It created a lot of atrocities. And I think what's happened is the old colonial absolutism was treated with a kind of philosophical relativism. And what I think conservative Christians are very worried about is that relativism weakens commitments. And they're worried that things like the Phoenix Affirmations will contribute to relativism. And I think this is the great challenge that we're all in together. We know that absolutism is unhealthy and destructive. And I think we're realizing that relativism also is destructive and that it erodes commitments. And whenever you erode commitments, you leave yourself open to manipulation. We're looking for something beyond absolutism and beyond relativism. And to me, this is one of the great struggles of our time as people of committed Christian faith, is we need a way to see people of other religions as our neighbors. And they're part of God's planet. And they exist, and their religions exist. And how do we come to terms with that? In the past, we had three options. I say this with some pain. One was to persecute them, either exterminate them or humiliate them. One was to ignore them, and one was to convert them. And I think, thank God, we've moved beyond, some of us, I hope at least, have moved beyond exterminating people of other religions, and maybe moving beyond ignoring them. In fact, you know, this all the conflict in our world today is saying we can ignore them, and people are saying you aren't going to ignore us. You're going to have to pay attention to us. But then we face the problem: what happens if we invite people to become Christians and they don't want to? And one of the reasons they don't want to is they look back on the history, see how we've treated them. Well, then we have to, I think, rediscover the great commandment, which is to love our neighbors as ourselves. And to find ways to realize that as Christians we're being faithful to Jesus, to respect the legitimacy of other religions. And let's just say by legitimacy, their right to exist. And that we have to treat every person with great love and respect. That's not being unfaithful to our Christian commitment. That's an expression of our Christian commitment. And at the same time, to realize that as Christians, we invite people to discover every good thing that we've discovered through Jesus and his message. You know? A friend of mine says his personal mission statement is reaching Christians for Christ, beginning with myself. This is one of our other challenges. We all need a lot of conversion ourselves to the way of Jesus.
Yeah. Last question. Where do you find hope these days?
You know, one of the most exciting things for me is in recent years, as I have been given some space to rethink my own faith and to look at the Bible in a fresh way, I really think the Bible is, in a sense, on the right side. You know, I think there are ways of reading the Bible that make it be on the wrong side, just like in our own history. A lot of we people in the United States, we don't realize that, for example, Colossians is maybe my favorite, you know, epistle. But Colossians 4 was constantly read in the civil rights era to legitimize slavery and to tell slaves, just do what you're told and don't cause any trouble. So I think what happened to a lot of people is they started to think the Bible is the problem. But I think what we're now realizing, no, it was our way of reading and interpreting the Bible that's the problem. And so I find a lot of hope in as I open the Bible and don't read it through those old lenses, but try to let it speak in a fresh way. Also, I'm traveling a lot, and in my travels, I meet so many people, the kind of people who came together for Crosswalk and the kind of people who you're bringing together in such beautiful ways, who to me represent a wonderful alternative to a kind of institutional and dry faith on the one hand, and a sort of rabid and vicious and maybe feverish faith on the other hand. But they represent a healthy, vibrant, alive faith. That's his motto.
Well, thank you. You've given me a lot of hope, I know, in the last few years, and I thank you for your own ministry of hope that you provide so many people across the United States and around the world.
Well, thanks, and please keep up the good work, and all the people who are connected through Crosswalk, I just think, you know, this is a growing movement that has a really important role to play, and I'm so grateful to be connected to you and all these people.
Thanks.